We were being conned. So I stopped recycling. I came to the conclusion that when I recycled, what I was really doing was letting myself off the hook. As long as I did my little paper, glass, metal separation duty, I wasn't required to do anything else to save planet Earth. Once my bottles and cans and newspapers were deposited in the appropriately colored barrels, I could press reset on my conscience and trust that someone else would do the rest of the job. Out of sight, out of mind, back inside my gas-guzzling minivan. Yes, I have a minivan. It gets about 15 miles a gallon, about 7 less than what the sticker said. I love this minivan. It's roomy, has a smooth ride, and sits a foot above the cars in front of me so I can see everything. I know some people say we Americans are spoiled by our low prices at the gas pump compared with the rest of the world, which pays up to 3 times what we pay. But hey, this ain't Belgium, where you can drive across the entire country in something like 35 minutes. We live in a huge nation. We need to get around. We got places to go, things to do. The rest of the world needs to understand that they benefit from our ability to get from point A to point B. How else are hard-working Americans supposed to get from their first job of the day to their second job at night, which is all part of a greater plan to create a global economy, if they don't have wheels? See, I come from Flint, Michigan, the vehicle city, not to be confused with the motor city. We're an hour north of Detroit, and at one time my hometown built every Buick in the world. They don't build Buicks there anymore. Growing up immersed in a car culture, you come to see your car as an extension of yourself. Your car is your stereo room, your dining room, your bedroom, your home theater, your office, your reading room, and the first place you do just about anything in your life that means anything. When I became an adult, I decided I didn't want a General Motors car, mainly because they broke down more often than I did. So I bought Volkswagens and Hondas and drove them around town with pride. If anyone asked me why I didn't buy American, I'd make them open their hood and show them the Made in Brazil plate on their engine, the Made in Mexico lettering on their fan belt, and the Made in Singapore label on their radio. Other than the tag on the dashboard implying the entire car was made in America, what exactly could they point to in their car that actually gave a job to anyone in Flint? My Honda Civic never broke down. For 8 years and 115,000 miles, I never had it in the shop for any reason other than regularly scheduled maintenance. The day it died, I was broke and on unemployment and stuck in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue, about 4 blocks from the White House. I just got out, pushed it over to the curb, removed the plates, and bid it farewell. I didn't buy another car for 9 years. Working most of the time in New York City, I didn't need one. Thanks to the city's fine mass transportation system and reliable taxi drivers, but because I spent a lot of time back home in Michigan, I got tired of renting from Avis and broke down and bought a Chrysler minivan. This much I'll say. You'll never see me stuff myself like a sausage by driving around one of those little tin cans again. The internal combustion engine has done more to create global warming than anything else on the planet. Almost half the pollutants in our air come from the stuff that spews out of your car, and that air pollution is the cause of some 200,000 deaths per year. Global warming is jacking up the world's temperature year after year, which can cause increased risk of drought in some countries and have dangerous effects on agriculture and health. We're perilously close to creating a horrible calamity if we don't figure out how to turn down the heat. But you should see how this minivan handles. And it's so quiet inside, that is, until I crank up my corn on the combination CD tape surround sound deck, complete with 8 bitchin' speakers. I can drive 400 miles straight with music cranked, the air conditioning cranked, the hands-free satellite phone ready to take that all-important call from Rupert Murdoch, thanking me for the fine work on this book and letting me know that my execution has been moved up to Thursday so as not to conflict with America's wackiest school shooting videos. Detroit has proved it has the technology to mass-produce cars that get 45 miles per gallon, and trucks and vans that get 35 miles per gallon. The year the auto companies reported their best gas mileage, 1987, during the reign of Ronald Reagan, the average car got 26 miles per gallon. Yet after the 8 years of eco-friendly Bill Clinton, who promised that cars would be getting 40 miles per gallon by the end of his presidency, the average miles per gallon for vehicles went down to 24.7. General Motors threw a lavish party in Washington for Clinton's 1993 inauguration. I guess it's just impolite to upset the host of a party given in your honor. Clinton's greatest gift to the big three automakers was exempting SUVs from the mileage requirements of regular passenger cars. Because of this exemption, these gas gluttons use up an extra 280,000 barrels of fuel each day. That fuel demand is one of the reasons the Bush administration is pushing to drill in the Arctic National Preserve in Alaska. Bush says the drilling will give us an extra 580,000 barrels of oil each day, enough to double the number of SUVs on the road. And yet consider, if SUVs had been forced by Clinton to meet the same gas mileage standards my minivan meets, an improvement of only a few miles per gallon, Bush would have no justification for drilling in Alaska. With all these SUVs on the road, I can no longer see over the vehicle in front of me. They're so big and intimidating, they're like a midget 18-wheeler on crack. What exactly is the point of an SUV? Initially, they were developed to give one the ability to drive in the middle of nowhere where there are no roads. I understand how that might make sense in Montana, but what the hell are all these yuppies doing inside them charging down a crowded street in Manhattan? How to use less gas. Hitchhike. It's free. You get to meet new people and have interesting conversations. Bonus feature? Strong likelihood of being featured in a supporting role on America's Most Wanted or in a Lifetime Woman in Danger made for TV movie. Live in a city with mass transit. But please don't come to New York City. It's already way too crowded. Try another American city with extensive, dependable mass transit forget it. Come to New York. I've got an extra room you can stay with me. Siphon gas from cars parked at airports. They're not going anywhere. It's a shame to have all that gas just sitting there going to waste in these waste-conscious times. Plus, it's a safety hazard. Just imagine what would happen if a plane were to crash into one of those airport parking lots with thousands of parked cars filled to the brim with highly explosive petrol. Just don't swallow. Drive behind large semi-trucks so your wind drag is reduced. Highway safety experts may advise against this practice, but it works. You can put the car on cruise and just sit back and enjoy the scenery. Drawback, you may find yourself in a remote truck stop having the crap beaten out of you by a guy with a tattoo on his forehead that says, "Itch me." Live in your office or place of work. Eliminates both the gas-guzzling commute and annoying monthly rent payments. Bonus, you'll impress the boss by always being the first one in and the last to leave. In June of 2001, a panel of top American scientists reported that global warming was a real problem, and it was getting worse. In their study, requested by the Bush II White House, the group of 11 leading atmospheric scientists, including several who were previously skeptical about the scope of the problem, concluded that human activity is largely responsible for the warming of the Earth's atmosphere, and that we're in serious trouble as a result. The release of the study put George, I sleep just fine Bush, in a tough spot. He and other members of his administration had pointedly avoided using the phrase global warming, and had repeatedly expressed doubts about the idea that air pollution was heating the atmosphere in dangerous ways. Bush also outraged international leaders in July of 2001 when he rejected the Kyoto Protocol, a pact originally negotiated by more than 160 nations, including the United States, and designed to reduce global warming. But now, Bush's own scientists were saying the Earth was on its way to a major catastrophe. Well, I don't know. Maybe young George has a point on this one. After all, I like it warm. Coming from Michigan, land of brutal winters and 3-week summer, I kind of enjoy this more temperate climate. Ask people if they'd rather have a nice scorching hot day at the beach, or a bitter frigid Alberta clipper that makes their tongues stick to their teeth, and I'll bet you 9 out of 10 Americans already have their shades on and the portable Weber in the trunk. So what if you need sunscreen that says 125 SPF? Last summer, though, something happened that I found slightly shocking. The New York Times reported that for the first time in recorded history, the North Pole had melted. A shipload of scientists boated right up to the top of the world, and the ice was gone. The news induced such panic that within days the Times ran a correction, trying to reassure us. It wasn't really melted, just a little squishy. Right. I remember the last time they tried to quiet things down, back in the 1990s, when they told us about the big asteroid that was heading for a collision with Earth sometime in the next 20 years. Again, they took it back immediately. But they should know we can see right through that kind of withdrawal. The powers that be are never going to tell us when the end is nigh, given the risk of mass pandemonium and subscription cancellations it would cause. The last ice age was the result of a global temperature change of only 9 degrees. Right now, we're halfway there. Some experts are predicting a rise in temperature of 10.4 degrees just in the next century. In Venezuela, 4 of the country's 6 glaciers have melted since 1972. The fabled snows of Kilimanjaro are almost gone. When the lighthouse at Cape Hatteras was built in 1870, it was 1,500 feet from the shore. By now, the tide has risen to within 160 feet of it, and the lighthouse has had to be moved further inland. A melting of the polar ice caps could cause the oceans to rise by up to 30 feet, in effect wiping out every coastal city there is and taking out the entire state of Florida, voting booths and all. I realize places like New York and Los Angeles could use a good scrubbing, but 3 stories of salt water over the whole island of Manhattan wasn't what I had in mind. How to survive global warming. Identify common household objects that could serve as flotation devices once the ice caps melt. Give special attention to items made of synthetic materials, which tend to be extremely water resistant. Don't forget to look outside, too. Those waterproof chairs with built-in cup holders will float just as well in the ocean as in your backyard pool. Who says catastrophic polar meltdown can't be fun? Examine topographical maps of your area to determine highest elevation. Map out quickest route there. Hold escape drills. Invest in Ziploc bags and those yellow waterproof cameras. Contact your local YMCA about swimming lessons. Take lessons now. Pay special attention to instructions for treading water. Change your vacation plans from Florida to Montana. Tell your kids to switch their spring break alcohol binge from Daytona Beach to Boise. Speaking of Florida, that state can also be held responsible for this sorry mess. Why? Ask Mr. Freon. Before air conditioning, Florida and the rest of the South were lightly populated. The heat and humidity were unbearable. I mean, you can hardly move on a 100-degree day in Texas. The air is so thick in New Orleans you can hardly breathe. No wonder people down south spoke with such an unintelligible drawl. It was just too damn hot to form a series of vowels and consonants. I believe this brutal, paralyzing heat is also the reason no great inventions, no great ideas, and no contributions toward advancing our civilization ever came out of the South, with a few notable exceptions. Lillian Hellman, William Faulkner, R.J. Reynolds. When it's that hot, who can think, let alone read? Then the air conditioner was invented, and suddenly you could actually get some work done in the South. Skyscrapers went up all over the region, and Northerners sick of the winter came down in droves. They found that you could drive to work in your air-conditioned car, work all day in your air-conditioned office, study all day in your air-conditioned college. Then you could go home at night to your air-conditioned house and planned the weekend's cross-burning and block club barbecue. Before we knew it, the South had risen and was now controlling the country. Today, the conservative ideology that was born in the Confederate South has the nation in its grip, mandating that the Ten Commandments be posted in public places, teaching creationism, insisting on prayer in school, banning books, fomenting hatred of the federal, northern, government, calling for reduction of government and social services, thirsting to go to war at a moment's notice, and looking to resolve any problem through violence. These are all trademarks of the elected lawmakers of the New South. If you think about it, the Confederacy has finally won the Civil War, a long-awaited victory won by luring stupid Yankees down there with a promise of 5,000 BTUs and a built-in ice maker. Now the South reigns supreme, and if you still don't believe it, just look at our last four presidential elections. If you wanted to win, you had to have been born in the South or adopted it as your home. In fact, in the last 10 presidential elections, the winner, or Supreme Court appointee, was the one with his feet planted most firmly in the South or West. No longer can anyone from the North get elected to lead the nation. Things the South was right about. Just to balance my portrait of the South as a land of sweat-stained clansters and latter-day corporate outposts, I've been asked to come up with a list of things we are thankful to the South for giving us. Here it is. Beef jerky. Lemonade. Fancy balls. Good manners. Country music. Napping in hammocks. Beauty queens. Michael Jordan. Walmart. Alligator wrestling. Walt Disney World. Air conditioning made it all possible. And now, having opened the door to Southern Pals and Dixie Climes, it's also promising to export those hot southern winds all over the world by making the hole in the ozone layer a reality. That hole is now over Antarctica and is 2.5 times the size of Europe. The ozone layer in the Earth's atmosphere protects us from ultraviolet radiation, which can give us cancer and kill us. The hole we've ripped in its fabric is caused by chlorinated fluorocarbons, chemicals typically used in air conditioners and refrigerators and as propellants in aerosol cans. When these chemicals are released into the atmosphere and struck by high-energy light waves such as ultraviolet light, they form compounds that destroy ozone. The biggest contributor of ozone-depleting CFCs? Car air conditioning units. One of America's favorite traveling companions. Which reminds me of another literally indispensable accessory du jour for hip young Americans on the go, bottled water. Why drink water out of a tap or fountain for free when you can pay $1.20 for the same thing and get a plastic bottle you can pretend to recycle later? I didn't always drink bottled water in New York. In fact, I used to put faith in the folk legend that New York's water supply is among the cleanest in the world. The water itself, I learned, is collected and stored in 22 open-air reservoirs in the Catskills and Upper Hudson River area and brought down to the city through an elaborate aqueduct system. It all sounded so pristine. But one night, at a party at a friend's house, an acquaintance remarked that he and his family try to get up to our cabin on the Croton Reservoir every chance we get. I asked, "How can you have a cabin on the shores of our drinking water?" "Oh, it's not right on the reservoir. It's across the road." You mean there's a highway that surrounds the water we drink? What about all the runoff from the road, all those oil spills and tire shavings and the like? Oh, they sterilize everything once the water gets to New York City, he replied. You can't sterilize anything once it gets here, I protested. By the time it gets to New York, it must already have every known germ-killing agent available to mankind already in full battle mode. He then went on to rhapsodize about how wonderful it is to boat around the reservoir. Boat? I cried. You're boating in my drinking water? Oh, sure. Fishing, too. The state lets us keep our boat right on the shore. That was when the cases of Evian began entering my apartment. Of course, the downside of drinking bottled water, other than the outrageous cost, is that, like the recycling bins, it prevents me from giving a moment's further notice to the state of our water in America. As long as I can sell enough books to afford my French spring water, why should I waste my time worrying about the PCBs General Electric has dumped in the Hudson River? After all, hundreds of years ago, the Indians dumped their refuse into the Hudson, and the early white settlers used the river as a non-stop sewage drain. And look at the great metropolis they went on to create. How to be sure your drinking water is safe? Lobby Congress to make bottled water the nation's official beverage. Reroute and connect city water pipelines direct to the sources of spring water used by commercial bottlers. If that means running feeder pipelines under the Atlantic to tap into some pure alpine water, so be it. We ran a telephone cable under the ocean. Surely we can lay a pipe beside it to quench our thirst. Manhattan is also a great place to get a steak. Until a few years ago, I don't think there was a day in my adult life when I didn't eat beef, and often twice a day. Then, for no distinct reason, one day, I just stopped eating it. I went a full 4 years without a morsel of cow passing my lips. I have to say, those were the four healthiest years I've ever had. Note, guys like me define healthy as I didn't die. Maybe it was just hearing Oprah Winfrey say on her show back in 1996 that learning about mad cow disease just stopped me cold from eating another burger. Of course, Oprah then had to contend with a threat that was equally dangerous. The Texas cattleman who sued her, and the former rancher and beef lobbyist who appeared on the show to speak about the dangers of mad cow disease for $12 million. They claimed that Oprah and Howard Lyman violated a Texas statute that prohibits the false disparagement of perishable food products. Please note that it was Oprah who said she was stopped cold from eating another burger, not me, because, again, nobody here wants to be sued. Oprah won the lawsuit in 1998, then, just to mess with their heads in Texas, she declared, "I'm still off hamburgers." I, on the other hand, have unfortunately fallen off the chuck wagon, nibbling every now and then on poor Elsie. You'd think I would have learned my lesson back in the mid-70s when instead of eating beef, I ate fire retardant. Like millions of Michiganders, I spent a year ingesting PBB, the chemical used in kids' pajamas, and didn't even know it. The PBB came in the form of a product called Firemaster, manufactured by a company that also happened to make cattle feed. At one point, they accidentally mixed up the bags they poured the stuff into and sent the fire retardant, labeled as feed, to a big centralized operation in Michigan that distributed the feed to farms all over the state. Soon the cows were eating PBB, and we were eating the cows and drinking their milk, full of PBB. The problem with PBB is that the body doesn't excrete it or eliminate it in any way. It just stays in your stomach and digestive system. When this fiasco was uncovered and we learned that the state of Michigan had tried to keep the news from the public, the residents of Michigan flipped out. Heads rolled, politicians were thrown out of office, and we were told that scientists had no idea what the PBB would do to us, and we probably wouldn't find out for another 25 years. Well, the quarter-century fuse has run out, and I guess the good news is that my stomach has never caught on fire. But I'm still sitting here full of anxiety, waiting for the other hoof to drop. I can't help thinking about Centralia, Pennsylvania, the town where residents continued about their daily business while underground fires raged on nonstop for years. Science does not have an answer for everything. Are millions of Michiganders fixing to develop fleece-lined cancers and kick the milk bucket? Or will we just lose our minds and find ourselves working for a candidate who can't win but can do a lot of collateral damage? I don't have the answers, neither does anyone else. If you know a native Michigander, and I guarantee there's one within shouting distance of you right now, thanks to the Reagan-sponsored diaspora of our people in the 1980s, ask her about PBB and see the ashen look that crosses her face. It's the dirty little secret we don't like to discuss. But there's a much greater bovine threat afoot among us today, one that knows no state or regional boundaries, one that deserves the Poeian moniker it wears like a bell around the neck. Mad cow. This is truly the scariest threat the human race has ever faced. Worse than AIDS, worse than the Black Plague, worse than not flossing. Mad cow disease has no cure. It has no preventive vaccine. Everyone who gets it dies without exception, a gruesomely painful death. And the worst part is that this is a man-made disease, born of a moment of human madness when we took innocent cows and turned them into cannibals. Here's how it started. Two researchers went to Papua New Guinea to study the effects of human cannibalism and how it made many Papuans go insane. They discovered that what these people were suffering from was a transmissible spongiform encephalopathic disease, or TSE. The native people called it kuru. What happens in TSE is that rogue proteins, prions, latch onto brain cells and twist into abnormal shapes. Instead of breaking down the way a good protein is supposed to do, these guys hang out and make a mess of your nervous tissue, leaving your brain full of holes like a wheel of well-aged Swiss. Turns out that in Papua New Guinea, these prions were being spread by cannibalism. No one seems to know where these prions originally came from, but when they get into your system, they wreak havoc. Some suggest that a mere speck of prion-infected meat, only the size of a peppercorn, is enough to infect a cow. Once the little buggers are released from the beef you've ingested, they spread like an army of pack-men, heading straight for your brain and devouring everything in sight. And here's the unbelievable part. You can't kill them, because they're not alive. The disease first entered the food chain in Britain through sheep, then spread to cows, when they were fed ground-up body parts of their fellow sheep and cows. Ultimately, the diseased beef was sold to the British public. The disease may lie dormant for up to 30 years before it unleashes its holy hell. Only after the deaths of 10 young people in 1996 did the British government acknowledge that something was wrong with the meat supply, something they had suspected for 10 years. The British solution for eradicating the source of the disease is to destroy any cow suspected of kuru, or mad cow disease, by cremation. But when you burn them, the threat doesn't disappear. You can't kill them, as I said. The smoke and ash just carry them to another location, setting them free to find their way once again to the British dinner table. Americans are not immune from this deadly disease. Some experts estimate that some 200,000 U.S. citizens diagnosed with Alzheimer's may, in fact, be carrying the alien protein, and that their dementia is actually a form of mad cow. Britain and many other countries have since banned the cannibalistic feeding of animals to their own kind, and no scraps or leftovers of food intended for humans can be used on cattle farms. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has followed suit, banning the feeding of animals to other animals of their own kind. But cannibalistic products still get through. And how's this for scary? Many drugs and vaccines, including those for polio, diphtheria, and tetanus, may have been made with products that could, in theory, carry mad cow disease. Both Britain and the United States have been slow to act regarding this growing plague. Make sure, if you have to eat a burger or a steak, to cook that sucker till it's black. The leaner the meat, the better your chances. Me, I'm going to stop eating all beef, unless someone can prove to me that the PBB I'm hauling around in my innards can vaporize the damn human brain-eating mad cow parasites. Where's the beef? Nowhere. How to become a Hindu. Entering Hinduism has traditionally required little more than accepting and living according to Hindu beliefs. Among those beliefs is that the cow should be revered as a mother to all because of the nourishing milk it provides. Therefore, slaughter of cows is sacrilegious. Generally, the steps to becoming a Hindu are: join a Hindu worship community, complete a course of study comparing Hinduism to other beliefs, discuss your changed beliefs with representatives of your former faith, and if needed, obtain a letter of release from your former religious organization. Adopt a Hindu name at a name-giving ceremony. Run an announcement in a local newspaper for 3 days, explaining that you have severed your ties with your former faith and have adopted a new name. Obtain a certificate testifying that an authorized Hindu priest has approved your entrance into the faith.